It's stretched out a little bit in the time domain, but in the amplitude domain, it's decreased. That's a speculation on my part. And what you've read about fiber, is there any possibility of the 8 degrees being a desirable angle to minimize intersymbol distortion of the multiple reflections at the balance? What do you think, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW?
I think this would not be traditional intersymbol distortion, but a reflection at an interface like that would most likely cause the signal to be reflected back towards the source, and then perhaps reflected at the source end and back forward. So it would not be, I don't think, one symbol interfering with the next symbol, but perhaps one symbol interfering with many symbols downrange. I also have a little trivia on semiconductor lasers and something they call chirp, if you're interested in hearing that.
Yes, I think I am, Bill. However, let me ask you this question. Let's assume now that you and I did a real nice job of, I'm going to call it grinding, the two surfaces that I'm about to bind. And although I'm making a sincere effort to make them optically flat, and I'd like them to be optically flat to the nearest 1/20th of a wavelength at the operating frequency. If the operating frequency was optical 550 nanometers, we're talking about 1/20th of that. It's a couple of nanometers, so to speak. And because you're going to have some kind of interstitial fluid, some kind of medium, glue or fab or silicone grease or whatever, between the two surfaces that are being mated, there is, in my opinion, a finite distance between the surface on the emitting fiber and the surface on the receiving fiber. There's a certain number of wavelengths between those two, fractions of a wavelength. Therefore, there is a multiple bounce between those two junctions. It's not just one single reflection, in my guess. But the one exception is that if you could make both surfaces flat to the nearest 20th of a wavelength and make the space between them a 20th of a wavelength, I'm not so convinced that that is doable in the real world. AC2IS, K2LIW, and the ticket man.
Hey, sir, Joy.
This is AC2IS. I think it's unlikely that people would want to make the gap between fiber interfaces, or the fiber air fiber, if you want to call it that, interfaces, a specific number of wavelengths or fraction of wavelengths, because fiber in general is intended to accept more than one wavelength of light, and in particular, wave division multiplexing involves having multiple different frequencies of light at the same time. This is not quite related to chirp, but maybe might touch on that a little bit. So let me break and then cover chirp.
Hey, you do, Jack.
I'm Bill. Eric, I know you've worked with fiber, so why is there an 8-degree tilt? K2EJ, K2LIW.
Alright, if you want to change frequencies now, you can. I didn't hear the whole conversation, but, there's a big difference between multi-mode fiber and single-mode fiber. Single-mode fiber, if you want to think of it as a single ray, because it's actually a smaller diameter, multi-mode fiber has a lot more reflections on it. It doesn't go quite as far. And the single-mode fiber, it's got a bandwidth limitation of about 1,000 gigahertz.
Yeah, what started this all off, Eric, is that Joe, who is working with fiber, was told that there's a very precise 8.00 degrees of surface preparation. 8 degrees away from normal is the surface that you prepare on the two ends of a fiber that you're about to splice. And Joe's original question is, why the 8.00 degrees? Why that exact number? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, well, you got to talk about the application, because there's some applications where you can't cut it at a 45 degree angle, and you can be inaccurate. You cannot have the perfect polish, but most of today's devices, actually, the way they make it so that the regular phone company guy can do it, they got a little machine that does it all for you. But you want to make sure, if you think of any surface, like an edge or a prism, okay, when you've got a perfectly straight edge, you get light that reflects back at you when you make a transition from one page to the next. If you put a very slight pitch on it, you actually cause, you could think of it as SWR, the reflected signal coming back at you. If you have a very slight pitch, okay, it goes off at an angle and is no longer part of the mainstream. Actually, that theory, not really a theory, that has changed a lot as the technology has changed.
Eric, when you polish those cables, do you believe they're able to polish them to a flatness of a small fraction of a wavelength, a tenth of a wavelength? And when the two pieces that are joined in the splice come together, do you believe that the gap between the two is left as air, or is there silicon grease or something else put in there? And is that gap a tenth of a wavelength again? What's your guess now as to the flatness, accuracy of the polish, and the amount of gap across the splice? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, the way they make it for the masses, as opposed to the old days, they have these little sleeves that you stick the fiber into. And essentially, the two surfaces, or the two pieces of fiber, they fit flush together. There are a number of different technologies where there's a transition that's made into, you can think of it as a barrel, where there actually is a glass that's in the barrel, but today's technology for like fires and other things is basically you make the two fibers together and you weld them with heat. So, in essence, there is no gap if you want to think of it like that.
Eric, I think your modulation is a little bit heavy. You might want to back off just a skosh. So you're saying they really get welded. In the case of a continuous gradation of refractive index, what do they call it now? GRIN. I think they call it graduated index of refraction type fiber, single mode fiber. Does it keep its GRIN-like characteristics across that melted weld? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
As with anything, when you interrupt something, or you actually add a barrier surface to it, there is a slight little bit of attenuation, but it's so slight with the weld. Before the days of welding the fiber, then you had to deal with making sure you had a perfect polish, you had a slight opposing pitch when you cut it, so that way you would get no reflections going back the other direction. Again, as the technology increases, these little splicing units that the guys use now, literally they have a little CCD camera, a CMOS camera inside it. It looks at it, magnifies it, looks at it, figures out the spacing, puts the damn things in the right place, makes the cut, polishes the end, or preps the end for the welding, and welds it with almost no operator intervention.
Very nicely done. Okay, I'm back in the normal mode. Interesting. So I think you're saying the human operator has been brought out of it. So I guess there's a bit of a mystery as to why Joe is running into this 8-degree number with the fibers that take place at his place of business. And so I guess there's a bit of a mystery as to why these modern welding techniques are not being done there. I wonder if you got a guess as to what's going on there, Joe. So the A2RYY, K2RIW, inquiring minds want to know.
Let me point out that the 0.8 degree business, if you think of a Herschel wedge with your telescope, how it functions, apply the same technique.
The Herschel wedge that I use with my telescope, the two surfaces are tilted away from each other about 20 degrees, Eric, go ahead. That's to make sure that one of the reflecting surfaces gives me the image that I want to go down the eyepiece into the ocular. The other image is so many degrees off
that it puts aside the scope where it's blackened and it gets attenuated. So in the case of a Herschel wedge, the wedge angle is a lot more than 8 degrees. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
It's not the degrees, it's the principle. The idea that light will, off an inside surface piece of glass, even though it's perfectly clear, will have a reflection.
Absolutely. In the case of the Herschel wedge, the reflection off of the glass is, let me pick a number, 5%. And you're looking for that 95% attenuation. You're using the Herschel wedge because you're doing solar observation, and the signal you're getting is too damn strong. It would burn up the glue in between the elements of your ocular if you didn't attenuate it. So the Herschel wedge is a primary surface reflecting device. The first surface does the reflection from the main mirror at a 45 degree angle into your eyepiece. The second reflection off of the back end of the wedge, so to speak, 20 degrees away, does not go down the path to the ocular, to the eyepiece. It goes off in some innocuous direction. So it is a primary reflecting device, and the reason you get a reflection at all is the fact that the glass has a significant difference in index of refraction compared to the air around it. Your main signal got gathered by the parabolic mirror, brought to a quasi-focus at the 45-degree mirror, so to speak, but you remove the 45-degree mirror and put in this piece of glass, this Herschel wedge, and it's the primary reflection that you're using there as an attenuator. KE2EJ, that's a bunch of guesses on my part. KE2LAW in the tech man.
Thinking, Dick. Okay, think of it as but the directional couple might be a sort of an idea. Whereas in other words, there's the primary, the thing that you're not looking at. That's actually straight through. The thing that you are looking at, which is attenuated, is at 45 degrees. So, if it wasn't 45 degrees, it was 0.8 degrees. The primary path would be straight, and whatever gets deflected will be 0.8 degrees off.
Yeah, but the way you and I use a Herschel wedge, with only 8 degrees of tilt, we would have...
I'm thinking it's the principle, that's all, the fact that light will reflect off of a parallel surface.
Okay, so do you believe that that Joe's company probably is no longer using an 8-degree polishing angle when they splice pieces of fiber? That you think that the more modern technique with grin-type fiber, single-mode fiber, is this welding technique? And do you believe the welding technique is now used 99% of the time? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Welding technique is the preferred method. I said, one thing I didn't give you is the reason for the 0.8 degrees. If you're using coherent light, and think of it as SWR, you have a bad termination at your antennas, you have RF flowing back down the cable. If you are using coherent light, and you have one wavefront that is reflecting back into the cable, you get an interference pattern, don't you?
Absolutely, you get an interference pattern, you get a standing wave ratio. You think it's 8-tenths of a degree. Joe remembers it as 8.0 degrees. We'll eventually refine that. So I think you're saying that the tilt of the polish on the two pieces being spliced means that now the reflected energy, the S11 in the network analyzer phenomenon, now goes into some innocuous direction, where I guess it gets attenuated and doesn't become part of the interferometry of the signal that you're trying to transmit. Is that approximately what's going on, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
You got the idea. What actually happens is it bounces on the side of the fiber, sort of like a multimode fiber, but because of the pitch, it becomes attenuated. And it doesn't interfere with the main feed, the main light source. Actually, that's not required in a non-coherent light source, but in a coherent light source, that's very required.
Bring me up to speed now, Eric. If I was studying fiber 10 years ago,
would everybody be using either 8/10 of a degree or 8 degrees, whichever it is, as the splicing angle? And now in 2012 and 2013, would you say the vast majority are using the welding technique, and therefore the exact polishing is nowhere near as critical? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
When you do the welding technique, it's like one continuous piece of glass. So, I mean, there's polishing that goes on before the weld to ensure that, you know, you have mating surfaces, and the thermal characteristics of the melt of the glass, so that way it's uniform, because you can melt glass and have it not be straight, so to speak.
If I understand correctly, the two pieces of fiber that are about to be joined, spliced, are put down this tube of some kind. I presume the tube is made of material that does not melt at the glass melting temperature, and therefore it becomes the form that holds everything just right until the glass cools. Then do you leave that tube there permanently, or is that then stripped away? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Some manufacturers have different methods, but think of it as this. You clear the jacket away and you're just left with the glass fiber. You clear the jacket away and you're just left with the glass fiber on the joining cable. You slide a sleeve that now becomes the protection after the weld is made that slides over the whole shebang and gets crimped onto the existing jacket.
Okay, so at the time the glass is being melted during the welding process, is there a sleeve in that vicinity holding the dimensions of the fiber, which is now a quasi-fluid? Or is the sleeve just something that slipped back on to the splice area, very similar to the way you and I use a H-ring piece of spaghetti tubing? Which one is it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
Put it like this. In the old days, if you're 8mm, 16mm film days, when you use a splicing block, you have one half that holds one half that holds the other half, and you can move them up and down. Basically, the reaction chamber, which is slightly larger than precisely the diameter, the outside diameter of the fiber that it fits into, and that whole shebang gets heated up, and then when the splice is finished, you lift and separate those halves from each other, and you wind up with one piece of glass fiber.
So it's not too different than a molding process. You've got a male and a female mold, so to speak, that are being brought together. And it's not too different than injection molding or other kinds of what's the word I'm looking for now? Casting a die. it's a molding process. Is that the way? In other words, the metallic object, I'm presuming it's a metallic object that holds the two fibers during the welding process, and the fiber itself, after it cools, does not adhere to the mold. The metallic mold is my guess. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
If you want to visualize it like this. Take a piece of copper pipe, okay, and precisely at the where you would measure the diameter, slice it down the middle so you have two ends. You know, you have a C and a C if you're looking at them. Okay, and essentially those two C's come together to make the whole circle, and that's precisely the outside diameter of the fiber. Okay, those C's get hot to the point where that the piece of glass inside will melt. You're only talking about, I think it's like 400 or 600 microns wide or something, some ridiculous number. It's not that big. The part that gets hot, otherwise you'd have to melt the whole thing. And it would take a lot of energy to bring the temperatures up that you need there. So these boxes are interesting. The amount of miniaturization, including the magnified view, because it has a little TV camera in it that actually looks up the surfaces and actually through pattern recognition figures out where the ends of the fiber are. Use some servos to move them in precisely the right place, and then applies this intense heat that welds the two of them together.
I'm going to guess that that intense amount of heat is done by an electromagnetic process. What do they call that now? Dielectric heating? No. It's the same kind of heating you got on a modern stove, where there's a RF coil heating the copper bottom of the pot that's cooking your food. I'm guessing that's a similar heating process. Eric, I recommend that you speak into your microphone 5 decibels lower in amplitude. I think you're over deviating, and I think you're giving us square waves, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Okay, well, I'm at one of the remote receive sites, so you probably get a little feedback agent from this. Anyway, I'll be back in a few minutes. You can keep going this way. K2RIW, K2J.
I think you spoke a little more softly that time, and the distortion was one-third as much. You could speak softer yet, more softly yet. Do we have any other expert here who has done fiber optic welding, fiber optic splicing? Give me your call letters right now. K2LAW in the TechNet.
AC2IS.
Okay, yeah, Bill recognized. AC2IS, go ahead, Bill.
Okay, I wonder if we're confusing two different things. So first off, I'd like to say that I've been talking about angled polish connectors, where, you know, the polishing process, if you were doing it manually, would be intensive and take a lot of time. Whereas the other caller there was talking mostly about splicing, which is a different process that involves fusing the cables. With angled polished connectors, you know, you're having two separate patch cords that you're mating, quick connect, quick disconnect kind of thing. And most of those are flat polished, but there are a few angled polished connectors.
The actual connector, which I presume launches the signal into the fiber, I think you're saying some of those are angled type. What is the emitter there? I presume it's something like a light-emitting diode, right? So, oh, there's a number of things it could be, but are we talking about the angle of polish between the light-emitting diode assembly of the launching structure of the connector and the rest of the fiber? AC2IS, K2LIW.
This is AC2IS. Okay, well, there's that part of things, too. The laser and typically in use today is a semiconductor laser, and typically there is a cavity in that launch area. So the laser is not directly up against the fiber, and there are, I believe, optics in the fiber intended to focus light down to the intended launch point into the fiber. So I don't know if that answers all of your questions, and I might be getting to the edge of my knowledge there. I don't know the size of that cavity, but I do know that the laser does not butt up against the fiber.
Any idea, Bill, what is the intermediate material between the laser and the fiber?
That's air. We're talking about situations where people are really concerned about getting production costs low and having stuff that's not going to be too finicky in the field that allows you to quick connect and quick disconnect fiber without having to do any preparation to the end. So yeah, that's air. The specific cases where you use angled polished connectors are, I think, kind of few and not so much used anymore. There you'd have patch cords with this angle on it. I don't know what the angle is. I don't know if that's 8 degrees or not. But that's typically used for video applications, which are not, I don't think they're digital even. At least they're not packet-based.
I'm reasonably sure, Bill, that the refractive index of the fiber is significantly different from air. So if there is an air gap between the light-emitting diode active element and the fiber, as the light-emitting diode, laser diode, launches some signal, a good percentage of it goes forward into the fiber. Some of it reflects off the first surface of the fiber, the polished surface, comes back to the laser, gets re-reflected forward. Therefore, you're setting up a standing wave in air. If there's a real air gap in there, there's going to be a standing wave. And as I go high enough in modulating rate, frequency, let's call it, the standing wave is going to give me interferometry. Where am I wrong with that simplistic analysis? AC2IS, K2LIW.
I don't think I can speak to that end of things. My understanding is that there is a cavity there and that it is an air cavity. What I've heard about angle polyflush connectors is that, you know, this is two patch cords of a specific type coming together, and the idea is to kind of convert that reflection that you get to more of a loss, so as to not have that reflection interference at those interfaces. It's sometimes used in test equipment as well as in the video field. So if you have a fiber test module, it may be looking for an angle polished connector there, because they don't want the test equipment itself to introduce more reflections Sorry, I think I timed out there, but they don't want the test equipment itself to introduce more reflections into an interface that it may be testing in order to measure reflections. Breaking again. Let's see. In regards to the chirp, the chirp that I was intending to describe much earlier is a phenomenon with the laser where, as the laser is turned on and off, as it's gated or modulated by a signal, that each time it's turned on and off, the frequency of the laser actually varies. And if that varies in the wrong direction, that can be a large source of inter-symbol distortion, or actually that can sort of cause the gap between the on and off signals to be lost on the other side of the connection. So there are things they do to mess with that chirp so that... Sorry, there was another break there. But the intention is that the frequency chirp in the appropriate direction so as to maintain the gap between that on and off, and to maintain that off gap between laser pulses.
Yes, there's a kind of test equipment that does a window display where you do a pseudo-random digital modulation, and with proper synchronization, that window should be quite far open, so to speak, between the, let's call it the mark and the space. Almost any oscillator that is being pulsed on and off will do a little bit of swooping, chirping, call it what you like. So the rise time and the fall time represents a period of time in which full voltage is not present and the normal operating frequency is not present. Is there a de-chirping technique, Bill? How do you minimize the chirp of a particular laser diode that you're trying to turn on and off in picosecond rates? AC2IS, K2LIW.
This is AC2IS. Comes to minimizing, that's getting into areas of physics that are beyond me. But I believe that the idea is that there is going to be some amount of this chirp, and if the frequency deviates in one direction, you end up with light that actually propagates through the fiber a little bit faster than your main intended frequency. If the frequency deviates in the other direction, it propagates a little bit more slowly. So what you want is to have, as the laser is turning on, to initiate with, a slower frequency of light, and the deviation at the end, the chirp at the as you're transitioning from a mark to a space, would sorry, there was another break there. The deviation at the end would you would use sort of a faster frequency of light, so as to not leave slower light that would blend into the space or the gap. Does that make sense?
KC2WBH.
KC2WDH. Sounds like Whiskey Delta Hotel or Whiskey Bravo Hotel. Let's go and find out. I'm going to go to you in a minute. What you're describing, Bill, sounds a little bit similar to what's called pulse compression demodulation. It's a kind of radar technique in which after the pulse comes on, you swoop it at a particular rate of megacycles per second. Is the megacycles per second, megahertz per second is the rate of swoop or chirp during the pulse, and then the pulse goes off. When that chirped pulse, transmitted by the radar, reflects off the target and comes back to the receiver, if that chirped pulse is put through a dispersive filter, where the group delay time of the filter is proportional to frequency or inversely proportional to frequency, then the net result is that you could be transmitting a pulse that is 10 microseconds long. Let me drop. You could be transmitting a pulse that's 10 microseconds long during the pulse duration, and the compression of the filter, taking the leading edge, which might be lower in frequency, but it goes through the filter faster, and the trailing edge of the pulse, which is higher in frequency, which goes through the pulse, goes through the filter more slowly, it all comes out time coincident. So you could get, in some cases, compression ratios of like 100 to 1. A 10 microsecond pulse could become a 100 nanosecond pulse. The advantage of doing that is you get a lot more higher equivalent power out of the transmitter, and you get a lot higher range resolution out of the radar. So carefully designed filters with a specific chirp of a pulse has some very specific advantages in a radar.
Didn't get it. If you have such a long signal, how the transmitter would work more efficient?
So you're describing a technique here, as I see it, Bill, where by using filtering techniques, you can, compensate for some of the natural chirp that the laser, the modulated laser is giving you. And so do they use fancy filtering techniques, fancy voltage waveform techniques? How do they compensate for this, Bill? AC2IS is going to get first, then we're going to turn it over to WDH in that order. AC2IS, K2LIW, go ahead, Bill.
And K2AJ.
I just wanted to get some information about there about gasoline.
Oh, is this WDH? Is it Whiskey Delta Hotel? And Rich Tate, K2KNB is present. Maybe he can give you some gasoline information. Let's see if Bill is, if Rich is present. K2KNB, K2LIW.
Fiber more slowly or more quickly than others. And that since this chirp is sort of a natural effect that can be minimized depending on how well you build your laser, but apparently cannot be eliminated, what they do is they choose to build a laser that sort of errs in a particular direction, that chirps in the most beneficial way. I don't think with the intent of compressing the entire pulse, but maybe compressing the leading and trailing edges.
Yeah, we doubled that, Bill, so stand by. Rich? We've got a man who wants to know about gasoline. K2KMB or anyone else who knows about gasoline, give me your frequency. Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet slash StormNet.
I'm just trying to fill in. I do know where there is gasoline. There's gasoline on Sunrise Highway in East Islip or Islip Terrace between Kennequot and Carlton Avenue with a very low line. So people in Suffolk County who need gas, this is a place to be.
Okay, please give me phonetically the call letters of the person who just gave that piece of information and also tell us your name, sir. Go right ahead.
Kilo Charlie 2 Whiskey Bravo Hotel. My name is Richie. I just wanted to get that out there before the gasoline was away for the people that don't have it.
Okay, Richie, so run it by one more time. What's the name of the station and the address of the station in street address and town, if you happen to know? Go ahead, Rich.
The name of the station is Gulf Station between Kennequot Avenue and Carlton Avenue on Sunrise Highway in the direction of westbound on the north side of the service road. It is a Gulf Station, and they have plenty of gas in the line. It's only about 25 minutes.
Okay, this sounds like you found out from personal experience, Rich. So, in other words, you just came from there, and they got plenty of gas and only a 15 or 25-minute wait. And did you find that by a website or by some form of networking, social networking, or did you find it out by word of mouth? Over to you, Richie.
I found it out by needing to get gas, and I came over here, and this is what we found. So, 25 minutes and that they have gasoline for only $4 a gallon. So, I just wanted to get that out there.
Very glad to hear that, Richie. Out of curiosity, does that station also sell diesel fuel? And is there a line for diesel fuel? Over to you, Richie.
AC2IS.
They are out of diesel fuel. So, as I'm turning here now, I think there is a Shell station next door that is currently serving diesel at $4.29 a gallon.
I will pick up with you in a second, Bill. Richie, so the station next door is selling diesel, and that particular Gulf station is out of diesel. Would I be correct in assuming that the line for diesel usually is much, much smaller in the places that have it? KC2WBH, K2LAW?
Yes, that is correct, Dick. There is no line for diesel fuel. Shell Station, Sunrise Highway, westbound between Kennequot Avenue and Carlton Avenue. Or should I say Hexter Parkway. Between Kennequot Avenue and Hexter Parkway and Islip Terrace.
Okay, you told us the Gulf Station has got gasoline, but no diesel. The Shell Station has diesel. Does the Shell Station have gasoline? Over to you, Richie.
No, it does not.
Okay, very interesting. Bill, if you've got information about gas or diesel, give us that information right now. AC2IS, K2LAW.
This is AC2IS. I did check earlier today, and I did hear on the air earlier today, somebody recommending to check, quote-unquote, Hess Express. And I did not find a direct link to a Hess Express site, but I was able to use that search term and hunt around for it and actually find a spreadsheet of updated daily, apparently, of all the Hess stations on the island and how much fuel they have in the tanks as of 8 a.m. that morning. That might be useful information if you want to get on a line and know that the station will not run out before you get to the end of the line.
That sure is interesting information. So if we do a search on Hess Express, if I understand you correctly, you get a website that tells you at least at 8 o'clock that morning how many thousands of gallons was in that particular tank. And then by a person doing a calculation as to how many gallons is going into the average car and how many cars are there, you can make a rough guess as to whether or not you stand a chance of getting gasoline, knowing how many cars downrange you are. Anyone else have any further information about gasoline? I'd like to believe that deliveries are happening as we speak and that we're eventually going to catch up with all this jazz, but there's a darn many people that have generators but can't get gas for them, or have automobiles and can't get gas for them to go to work. is certainly a darn unpleasant situation. Anybody with any further gasoline information, give us your call letters right now. K2LAW.
WB2CUK, Farmingdale.
Go right ahead, Bill. And by the way, boy, am I terrible in recognizing people. He sounds just like the guy that for a zillion years has been running the swamp and shop. WB2CUK, K2LAW. You got it, Bill.
Yeah, when I remember, sometimes I forget. There's a BP station on Hempstead Turnpike going eastbound that I saw a couple of hours ago. But a long line. Then there's, of course, the BJ's. They were selling gas today. And I'm trying to think of where the other station was. But I think it's 7-Eleven also in Farmingdale on Main Street. Three stations with long lines. But the one tonight at about 7 o'clock looked like there were like about 20 cars online, so it wasn't too bad. I got to go. The wife is calling.
Okay. There was a person signing in. Who was that? Anybody with any further gasoline information, give me your call letters right now.
NY2H with gas information.
Go right ahead, Lou.
There's a website, gasbuddy.com/Sandy. GasBuddy, one word, .com/Sandy. And people are posting on that site. You put in your zip code, and people who have entered information as to whether or not a particular gas station in your area has gas. GasBuddy.com/Sandy.
Sounds like darn good information, Lou. Have you used it, Lou? Do you believe it's accurate? Is the feedback that everybody who uses it gets what they're finding? In other words, essentially every station in the area, when you give them a zip code, they'll tell you every station in the area within the nearest 5 or 10 miles, and no one's complaining about inaccuracy. What do you believe is the track record of GasBuddy.com/Sandy? NY2H, K2LAW.
Alrighty, so this is an offshoot of a mobile phone app called GasBuddy. The GasBuddy app was used for pricing, so if you wanted to see where one of the lower prices were in your area on your phone, you could type in your zip code and it would give you that information. And again, it was crowdsourced. It's other people putting this information in. And I'm familiar with that app, and that app was pretty accurate. When Sandy came along, the makers of that app did not have the wherewithal to get another mobile app operating right away, but you can, through a standard web browser on your computer, go to guestbuddy.com/Sandy and avail yourself of finding out whether or not the particular station has gas. So this is a very short-lived thing. It was just set up. But based on their other application, the credibility was quite high. So hopefully, you know, you have the same people contributing and they're doing it as accurately as they've done in the past. Other than that, you know, I just heard about it today. And, you know, you'll have to check for yourself, but it is available and it might be helpful.
Sounds good, Lou. Sounds good information. Out of curiosity, Lou, how do you stand on gasoline? In other words, did your car in the last week have to be filled? And how long did you have to wait in line at what location? NY2H, K2LAW.
K2RIW, NY2H, yes. Earlier in the week, I believe it was Friday, I went on a line that was a half a mile long according to my GPS, and it took just under 2 hours, and I was able to fill up my tank. There was a $50 limit. I had some gasoline in the tank already, so I ended up with a full tank. I had to do some traveling over the weekend, but I still have a fair amount of fuel, and we are planning a trip to Pennsylvania Friday, so hopefully I'll still have enough fuel. I don't plan to use it. You know, I work in Farmingdale,
had to take the one grade blue. And second of all, during that two-hour wait, where people are turning off the engines and restarting them those 50 times, so to speak, which is a lot of work on the starter motor, or with the more athletic people leaving the car turned off and pushing it. You don't want to sit there and idling the automobile and run out of gasoline. NY2H, K2RIW.
Yeah, what I failed to tell you was the station. The station was a U.S. U.S. Petroleum or USA Petroleum. It was on Route 112. And we had a police presence, which was good. They maintained order because a couple of times people tried to cut in and the police straightened that out right away. It was one grade. I don't even know what grade. Yeah, you really didn't have a choice. What else? That was, well, that's about it. What can I say? I'm trying to think to see if there's any other details. But yeah, that was the experience. I'm sure, you know, other people have had the same or similar experiences. They did have a line of people with containers also. That was a separate line. And, you know, you mentioned diesel before, and I wonder if someone needed diesel. There was no separate line for diesel, so they would still have to wait, and God forbid they tried to cut in, they would have had hell to pay. So even if they wanted diesel, they probably would have to endure the same wait. Oh, yes, and as far as starting up the motor over and over, I did not. I did it a few times, but I realized that the idling wasn't consuming that much fuel, so I would idle probably for most of the time online. Back to you.
Now, in many gas stations, Lou, the diesel pump is a completely separate pump. Therefore, you could run a parallel operation of a diesel line versus a petroleum gasoline line. Or you're talking about a gas station which really has a dual function pump where the pump can be flipped to either diesel or gas. There, everybody's got to get on the same line. But there are some gas stations where the diesel pump is a thoroughly separate pump. So why wouldn't they be able to run a parallel diesel line and gasoline line in that case, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, NY2H. I think, Dick, it's a matter of logistics. A number of these lines are actually intruding into the roadway so that to maintain one line is a challenge enough, and I think for them to get a little bit more clever would have been difficult. I noticed the behavior on these lines as far as courtesy. You know, people were courteous to each other, but no one would leave a space for a driveway or even intersections. You know, that was, I found kind of odd that they wouldn't leave a space. They just weren't thinking, you know, about other people in that sense. The person in front of me had to push their car for a while because they were out of gas. But someone, a couple of cars up, came back with a container and gave him some gasoline. And this kid is pouring the gasoline into his tank with a lit cigarette in his mouth. And I kind of rolled down my window and I said, you know, you probably should put out the cigarette. He kind of looked at me askew and took a while, but he eventually did. So, you know, it takes all types. Back to you.
Amazing. The reason why I thought, and I might be naive here, that there could be a separate line for diesel, is for two factors. One, in some stations, it's a thoroughly separate pump. Second of all, when it comes to domestic vehicles, I'm not talking about commercial vehicles, but on ordinary consumer vehicles, and some very few motor generator sets, the number of people using diesel is like a couple of percent. So it's a much smaller percentage of passenger vehicles that are diesel-fired or generators that are diesel-fired. So therefore, the line for diesel could be an extremely short line in some cases, is my guess, Lou. So it wouldn't require tremendous logistics for the diesel line as a double 50-car long line, if you know what I mean. NY2H, K2RIW.
Yeah, I agree with you. Again, I don't know who would devise it, if the station owner, or maybe in concert with the police. Not all these stations and lines have police presence, but I think a lot of them do. And it would make a hell of a lot of sense because, you know, like you say, the percentage is small. But I think as of now, regardless of whether the tank was a separate entity, or the pump rather, or it was an integrated pump with the other grades of gasoline, I don't see any of the stations doing that. So it would seem that even if you were the one car that needed diesel, you probably had to wait. And certainly if you tried to go in front of the line saying, hey, I'm only looking for diesel, you probably would get plummeted by the people. I don't think. And what if you needed air in your tire? Here's another example. If I need air in my tire, can I jump in front of the line? They're not gonna let it happen. It's like mob psychology. So whether the intentions are good or not, they may not believe you, and that's what's going on, as far as I could tell.
So are you saying there was one police officer patrolling that line of 50 cars and stopping anybody that thought of breaking in, and I'm guessing that the people were blocking driveways and blocking cross streets for fear that if they left a gap, it would be an invitation to a jump in there. Is that an approximate what was going on, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW?
Yeah, that was precisely what was going on. Some stations had two or three policemen. The station I was at, when I was very near, a storefront or two away from the station, actually there was a shopping center and there was a driveway, so I left a little space, and there was a cab driver, and I left the space so he could go enter traffic into the street, but he rolls down his window and he says, I'm on empty, and he goes into the line. Well, everybody behind me, apparently everybody is eagle-eyed because the horn started blowing, and, you know, through their horns alone, they read him the riot act, and he got the hint, and then he went on his way with his tail between his legs because they were not going to allow any of that. So that's basically the experience, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, that's a sad state of affairs because there's a guy trying to earn his living, a taxi cab driver, and he can't do it without petrol. You and I get inconvenienced when we can't drive our car, although in your case you're trying to go to work. Sounds like Bill's got something to say on this. AC2IS, how do you get gasoline, Bill? K2LIW?
Well, I'm not left with much fuel in my car right now. I've been volunteering with the Red Cross and at the location in Mineola, which is a long commute. I've actually, last night, I slept in Mineola and did not come home just because I didn't really have the gas to do it. But you can occasionally, in the Red Cross, go to a non-commercial gas station. You can get special dispensation with the appropriate paperwork. Quite a hassle. I did notice at a closed gas station, or one that was open but had no gas, that there was almost an altercation with a guy going in to get air in his tires. So I just wanted to mention that. Breaking for a moment here. Another thing I wanted to point out was that the reason you can't have a separate line for diesel is because that these pumps are in line, so that to get to the gas pump you have to drive right past the diesel pump or vice versa, so there's not really an opportunity to drive a separate set of vehicles to the diesel pump. But maybe if you were carrying a diesel fuel can, you might be able to do that. It's just a suggestion.
A question that I have for the group is that I've heard that many of the modern-day automobiles on the gas filler pipe that goes into the fuel tank of the automobile, there is a spring-like device which stops you from putting a siphoning tube in there so that if you wanted to siphon out the gasoline from your automobile tank to run your generator, you might not be able to do it. And I presume the original reason for that spring to be put there, if it's there, is to stop people from stealing gasoline. Does anybody know, is this story that I've heard true? And if so, do all cars in the last 10 years have it, or only the last 5 years? What do we know about the spring in the filler tube stopping a siphoning operation? K2LIW listening, please give me your call letters.
K2AZM, Everton is the name, and I'd just like to say that not all cars have the spring. Some of them have a baffle, which would stop you from putting a siphon line down in the tank. Did you go ahead?
Okay, I heard something to AZM, and I missed your handle. So you're saying there is a baffle. So even with that baffle, if I had a flexible enough piece of tubing, if the fuel can get down there by going around the corner, and if I've got a flexible piece of tubing, couldn't I still do that? Mr. AZM, give me your full call letters and your name slowly, K2RIW.
So Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu Mike, and the name is Everton. Echo Victor Echo Romeo Tango Oscar November. And to answer that question is, a lot of times if you put plastic tubing down there, when you get ready to pull it back out of the tank, sometimes it gets caught on the sharp edges of that baffle.
Okay, Everton, so if I understand you correctly, siphoning gas out of a modern-day automobile sounds like it's very difficult or maybe almost impossible. And, Everton, is this only the last couple of years of automobiles, or if I go back 10 or 15 years in an older car, is that baffle still there? KC2AZM, K2LIW.
This idea came about when we had the last gas rationing back in the 70s, Dale.
2LDY. Okay. Many of you guys are talking first and squeezing late, and so I only heard the 2LDY. Give me the full call letters and your name, sir, and your information on this area. Blank, LDY, K2RIW.
Bembus. Well, that is the case, but, you know, if you just think about this a second, you want to pull that tubing out and it's getting caught, all you need to do is take a screwdriver or a ballpoint pen or some long little thing and just press that little flapper down and take it away from the tubing and then pull the tubing out and then let the flapper go. So it's not a big deal.
Very fine, Don. Yes, there is a flapper up top that the gas filler object from the gas station pushes to one side. And yes, with a small piece of tubing or wire, or, like you said, a fountain, a ballpoint pen, you can control that upper flapper. What Everton was saying makes it sound like there is another baffle further downrange. So do you know, Don, of anyone who has successfully, with your technique, siphoned gasoline out of a modern automobile? N2LDY, K2RIW.
Oh, see, I must have missed part of that, because I don't know of any other baffles down inside there, but I guess there could be. Can he specify on what type of car he might be talking about? Maybe we could look it up.
Everton said that since the oil embargo of 1972, that this device, this baffle, is in essentially all automobiles since then, is what Everton was saying. Anyone with any further information as to whether or not, in a modern-day automobile, can you successfully siphon gas out of the tank in order to run your gasoline-powered motor generator set? Does anybody have any information on whether or not that can be done? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
KC2MDP.
I should know you very well. Mr. MDP, go right ahead. Please tell me your name one more time.
Yeah, Dick, the name over here is Steve. Here's one for you. My boss, he's got a brand new Ford.